Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning, everyone. It's State of the Union Day, President Biden's chance to get an audience bigger than those of you who watch MSNBC or CNN all the time, right? According to Variety magazine, the Super Bowl was the most watched show of 2022, with around 100 million viewers. Depends on how you calculate it. The NFL says 200 million, but we'll accept the first Nielsen number, 100 million viewers. The most viewed entertainment show was the Oscars at around 17 million, then the season finale of Yellowstone with around 13 million, and the State of the Union address last year, take your internal guesses, what's your over-under, it drew a little under 40 million people. Not too bad. Now, that's barely over 10% of the American population paying attention, but that's still the biggest news event audience of the year. And in historical context, it's still meh. The most watched State of the Union address ever, according to the Nielsen ratings, was Bill Clinton's just after his inauguration in 1993. You know, we just did that series on 1993. Did you hear that as a turning point? That was one reason why. Charismatic Bill Clinton had everybody paying attention, and it was a new era that America felt was dawning then after the Cold War and as the country was beginning to recover from the worst of a recession and of 1980s crime. 66 million people watched that State of the Union, more than half again as many as watched Biden last year. And as another footnote to history, just saying, Donald Trump claimed his 2018 State of the Union address was the most watched ever. It wasn't. Nielsen clocked that at around 46 million viewers, so 20 million less than Clinton's 66 million, which was the best ever, according to Nielsen. But we know that not coming in first never stopped Trump from saying he came in first. Maybe we'll call that the little lie. A footnote to State of the Union history. But tonight, it's Joe Biden's third State of the Union address. We'll see who watches. But what does the president need to do tonight? Well, here's his former press secretary, Jen Psaki, on MSNBC this morning.
Even if it's 40 million people watch it, which is less than the Super Bowl, but still that's a huge number of people. That's a big opportunity for any president. It's the biggest speech of the year any president gives. But what he needs to do is tell a story. Joe Biden is an amazing storyteller. I mean, you sit in the Oval Office, Karine can tell you, and he can storytell for 6 hours. He needs to do that in the speech tonight. People aren't sitting at home and just like writing down data points, right? They vote and they move. They support people who they feel something from. So he needs to tell the story.
He needs to tell the story. But with Democrats and Republicans alike in a pessimistic mood, according to the polls, and Biden's latest approval number at just 37%, what kind of story does he have that he can tell? Well, one thing we expect is for Biden to tout the economy, right? With the lowest unemployment rate since 1969, according to the numbers that came out on Friday, and the U.S. manufacturing sector once more or less left for dead. Thank you, 1993, by the way, with Bill Clinton's NAFTA agreement and other forces. The American manufacturing sector is coming back with Biden-era laws, including the CHIPS Act and the Inflation Reduction Act. In fact, here's something that surprised me from this show yesterday, from our own show yesterday, that could even help Biden tell his story. Some of you heard our call-in at the end of yesterday's show asking people if they recently got a job or recently lost a job. And we got this revealing call from Robert in Jersey City, who started by saying he had been laid off from his recruiter job in the tech sector. We know the tech sector is shrinking, but then he went on.
I'm actually a tech recruiter. I work for a lot of great Fortune 500 companies, and there's a huge push in U.S. for made in USA, right? So there's a lot of jobs in manufacturing. And I've actually, within the last 1 month, I've actually gotten 3 offers, all from the manufacturing sector instead of the software, which I'm part of.
What a reversal compared to what we're used to, right? Lost his tech recruiter job, got a manufacturing recruiter job. As those sectors kind of switch places, as what's growing, what's shrinking, the story of January 2023 in less than 30 seconds there. So let's preview the state of Joe Biden's union by talking about the state of Joe Biden's economy with Idris Kaloun, Washington Bureau Chief for The Economist. One of their recent articles is called America's Government is Spending Lavishly to Revive Manufacturing. Idris, thanks so much for coming on State of the Union Morning. Welcome to WNYC.
Well, thank you so much for inviting me. I really appreciate it.
First, can I get your reaction to that caller yesterday, Robert in Jersey City? Was he kind of an accidental focus group of one?
No, I think that makes a very interesting point because, as you noted, manufacturing jobs are up. So they hit their bottom around 2010 at 11.5 million jobs. They've since gained about 1.5 million. Which is, a bit of a reversal. But what we see actually is that a lot of those jobs require technical skills. They require college degrees, even though they are part of the manufacturing sector. There is still a place for brawn in that sector, but a lot of it is computerized, a lot of it is automated, and the kinds of jobs that are being created require a certain set of STEM skills. And so in that way, I think that the focus group of one is actually quite revealing.
But the article in The Economist about this starts at what we might think of as an old school location where mostly it was brawn, as you put it, doing the work. The article opens at a Ford Motor Company manufacturing complex called River Rouge near Detroit. And you describe what was happening there in the 1930s and then what's happening there today. You want to tell both of those stories a little bit?
Yeah. So in the 1930s, this complex outside of Detroit had roughly 100,000 people who were making cars, once a minute. It was a huge enterprise. And, it was the heyday of the American manufacturing sector. It was when Detroit was the fourth largest city, was incredibly rich. All the Art Deco buildings that we see today were being built. And we've all, known about the decline of Detroit since. But actually, what's interesting is if you go back now, what you see is that this complex is now churning out electric F-150s. And my colleague who wrote that particular briefing had a good time taking it all the way across a few states. Actually the issue was less the car, which worked fine, but the charging stations along the way.
I was just going to ask, did he run out of charge before he found a charging station?
So she went with two colleagues and they had to spend a very cold dinner outside of a supermarket while they waited for the car to charge up. In a lot of ways, the sector is changing. If you go there, my colleague noted that, you see the whirring of machines. You don't see the sort of legions of people producing cars like you had before. And what they're producing is fairly high quality. It's advanced. I mean, it's almost futuristic. But it is a very different kind of manufacturing, and it's one that the Biden administration is spending a lot of money trying to encourage at the moment.
Right. And that gets to the heart of the article. One reason for the revival of River Rouge is lavish new tax credits people can get for buying American-made electric vehicles, for example. And I'm glad you told the story that way because I think the American-made part of that sentence, American-made electric vehicles, tends to get lost in most of the media. What we hear a lot is about the tax credits themselves, right? In the context of trying to reduce climate change. We did a segment like that here last month as our climate story of the week, 1 week. How are you trying to take advantage of those new green energy tax incentives for cars or things for your home or whatever? But if you buy an American-made electric car, you get more of a tax credit than a Japanese electric car or other import?
That's right. So the IRS has set up for the individual a $7,500 tax credit that you can receive for an electric car. Now, there are requirements on precisely how much of that car needs to be made within America. So a few automakers whose supply chains don't run through America in quite the same way, are a bit irate about that. But to your point, I mean, this goes at, you know, the central tension of the article that we try to explore, which is, you know, for the first 2 years that Biden had, that President Biden had unified control over Congress, he managed to pass quite a lot of legislation. And a lot of that was geared towards spending, and spending with a few aims. It was, you know, roughly $2 trillion to be spent on semiconductor manufacturing, clean energy manufacturing, with the intent of revitalizing the sort of American manufacturing sector, bringing people back to work, competing with China, and preparing the economy for this massive decarbonization that needed to happen. And it does that by relying in large part on these sorts of Buy America provisions, on domestic subsidies. And, you know, the argument the administration makes is that these subsidies will ultimately reduce the cost of providing clean energy, of wind and solar innovation that can be transmitted to the rest of the world. The skeptical, pessimistic view on what this money might do is it might encourage, you know, domestic giants that aren't that efficient, that basically are able to subsist on subsidies for a while, whereas the actual products that they produce are not going to be the sort of epoch-changing ones that we hope that they will be. So that is the big gamble that we're writing about, and that we're going to continue to write about. Also, this isn't our first stab. We're going to be spending much of the year looking at this.
But even if they exist on subsidies for a while, I presume that means they're creating jobs, because so far what we've talked about, what I pointed to, is what your article calls the indirect subsidies of subsidies for the buyer. There are also government subsidies going directly to the manufacturers?
Yes, there are. And for a variety of kinds of products. So there's the wind and solar subsidies. We've had those for a while, actually, and they probably helped reduce the cost per kilowatt hour of providing those renewable energy sources, such that they are now competitive with non-renewable resources. For more experimental ideas, such as carbon capture, advanced nuclear reactors, hydrogen production. So there is money going there, and potentially that money might have the best return, because that might encourage the sort of research and development that is needed to make these technologies more mainstream.
So just staying with automaking for a minute, are there many River Rouges popping up around the country right now?
You know, there are. So we have a chart that the White House is very proud of that we put into our piece about new starts of semiconductor factories. Those are the ones that are sponsored or helped subsidize by the CHIPS Act, and electric vehicle and battery plants. And those are manufacturing facilities that have been subsidized in part by the Inflation Reduction Act, which is kind of a bad name for what is basically a huge climate change legislation. And you see it all over the place. You see Hyundai, you see Ford. States are getting in on the action as well. You know, they're setting up their own subsidy programs. They're competing with one another to see who can attract the most jobs. And we saw even in Georgia, when I was covering that race for governor, you know, one thing that Brian Kemp emphasized, aside from the national culture war and these sorts of things, that was the way that it got covered, was, you know, the fact that he got in an electric manufacturing plant from a company called Rivian. That was a big part of the campaign that was maybe missed if you only looked at it from the D.C. angle. So it's really quite a big change that we're seeing already.
And the article puts Ford's River Rouge complex into broader context. You write, it's not just that factory enjoying a renaissance, but the American dream of a country made prosperous by multitudes of jobs in cutting-edge manufacturing, mostly in two sectors, according to the article, green energy and semiconductors. And that brings us to the other main Biden-era law that Congress passed called the CHIPS Act. All right, Idris, for 25 bonus points, can you state what CHIPS is an acronym for?
You know, I'm gonna forfeit the bonus points. Can you can you help me
yes,
out?
Yes, yes.
Infrastructure cheated, protection, is that in there? What is
no,
it?
No, no. I cheated. I wrote it down. It's the Creating Helpful Incentives to Produce Semiconductors Act. Creating, so CHIPS, right? Creating Helpful Incentives to Produce semiconductors. Tell our listeners, what's a semiconductor? I mean, common word, right? But the layperson using their personal tech toys may not know what part of what is a semiconductor.
Yeah. So if you remember back to science class, you have things that conduct and things that don't. And semiconductors are somewhere in between. So they can conduct a bit of current. And that makes it very useful for basically any sort of electronic information. If you want to store data in terms of bits, you need semiconductors. And these are largely silicon. And these are basically produced in these massive facilities that are really, really complicated because you need to pack a lot of semiconductor into a very small place. And, you know, as chips have gotten better and better, they've also enabled the sort of powering of computers that are just, you know, better and better every year. You know, the moon landing was done with some trivial amount of computing power, which now exists on the average middle schooler's graphing calculator. You know, we've advanced quite a lot such that we can now have this conversation over the internet live. But these chips are important not just to the economy. I mean, so Ford, for example, I believe had an issue manufacturing trucks last year because it didn't have enough semiconductors for its windshield wipers. And the average car has something like maybe more than 40 semiconductor chips that are needed for it. So it's used in all sorts of industries. The advanced chips.
And that's a great story. That's really a funny story too, right? Because the last thing that people were thinking of when I asked the question, what's a semiconductor and what's it in? Probably the very last thing that was on people's mind was windshield wipers.
Yeah, yeah. It's in your windshield wipers. It's in, you know, modern fridges and ovens and anything that has a little, like, cute little Wi-Fi enabled logo next to it, which a lot of things do require chips. And so for the functioning of a typical for a modern economy relies on chips. It's used, you know, the advanced ones, the sort of cutting edge ones are needed for supercomputers. They're needed for warfare increasingly, which is fought based on technological advantage. And the problem that the CHIPS Act tries to solve is that right now the most advanced chip making happens in Taiwan by a company called TSMC. And no one can produce chips as good as this company effectively. And, you know, America is very concerned that if China were to try to occupy Taiwan, as a lot of people in DC fear that they will within the coming years, that they would no longer have access to those advanced chips. And there's an effort to make sure that supply lines for the chips that power the modern economy, that power the defense sector, can be made domestically or at least among allies. So America set out this CHIPS Act, which is basically trying to make sure...
Well, Taiwan's an ally, right?
Taiwan is an ally, that's right. But, you know, for example, the Netherlands are very good at producing chips, and there's less fear that China might get involved in a war with Amsterdam that inhibited the flow of chips. So, you know, the Europeans are also subsidizing domestic chip production, and America is also getting in on it now. So they've set up this CHIPS Act, like you mentioned, which has this very cute abbreviation, like all laws that pass in D.C. do, except for the Inflation Reduction Act. They lost their creativity there. But, you know, that aims to spend somewhere between $50 billion, depending on how you count it, or $200 billion on subsidizing companies such that they can produce chips here. So that, you know, the supply lines don't require or don't run into the possibility of conflict.
That was a pretty good description of what semiconductors are used for, by the way. My producer Mary said in my ear as you were giving that answer, pretty good for a Washington bureau chief.
Thanks. I really liked physics when I was in high school. So.
Oh, yeah. Plus, you're the Washington bureau chief for The Economist. Maybe the Washington bureau chief for some political magazine wouldn't be able to do what you just did there. But listeners, if you're just joining us, my guest is Idris Kaloun, Washington bureau chief for The Economist, as we preview the State of the Union address in a narrow kind of way, but with topic one most years on most people's minds, and that's the economy and things that are happening, especially in the manufacturing sector, with acts that have passed Congress under Biden's watch. Listeners, does anyone work in any kind of manufacturing that is being affected by Biden policies in any way? Help us report this story. We had that one caller yesterday that we played at the beginning of the segment. We'd love to hear from more of you who work in manufacturing, or for that matter, any sector that you think is being affected positively, negatively, not much at all, by Biden-era policies, things that actually have gotten through Congress. 212-433-WNYC. Help us report the story at 212-433-9692 or tweet at Brian Lehrer. So if the CHIPS Act stands for creating helpful incentives to produce semiconductors, meaning to produce semiconductors here, how does the CHIPS Act subsidize or otherwise incentivize making things like that here rather than in Taiwan, as you mentioned, or other places where some of the best of those products come from these days? How does it incentivize that?
There are two ways. So one is the direct subsidies that would go to, say, I'm Intel or TSMC, which also is interested in setting up plants in America. So they would receive some of the money to help set up the plant. So these semiconductor facilities are hugely capital intensive. They can cost billions of dollars to produce. So the government will help defray some of that cost. That's one pillar. A bigger part actually is the research and development spending, which would go to universities to develop basically innovations in the quality of chips. So there's a very famous law called Moore's Law. I think it was named after one of the founders of Intel, which said that basically computing power doubled every 2 years. Basically, the pace of innovation has been so fervent that we've been able to count on that for the last few decades.
And actually, which makes you have to buy a new laptop or something every 2 years in order to keep up. But that's another story.
Yes, it does. It does. But, you know, also applications are designed to take advantage of this, such that, you know, games that you could play on, you know, 10 years ago now no longer work. But, you know, the problem that we're running into is actually now the amount of semiconductors that we're able to fit onto a single narrow postage stamp size space. You know, these are nanometers apart. So, you know, innovation is, space is getting tight. You know, people are looking into things like quantum computing, which is the level that you're having to get to now to produce more innovation. So, you know, the pace might slow, but the American government is hoping to increase the pace of research into this area.
Is it too soon to ask if all this is working to create manufacturing jobs?
Yeah, I think that we will have a better sense in the years to come. So one of the things that we're going to be paying attention to, you know, we think at The Economist that this is a huge potential transformation of the economy, but there were a few barriers that might keep it from doing the things that it hopes to do. One, you know, this might just end up being a subsidy rather than producing innovation. That's one thing we're going to keep an eye on. Two, you know, one big hindrance to you know, production of new facilities are permitting laws. This is kind of boring sounding, but the fact is that it can take up to 5 years to get a permit to create a new solar plant. Wind turbines also that we know will be necessary to help decarbonize the economy in some cases can take 6 to 7 years of permitting time because of the environmental reviews and such. So if all this money is allocated, and it takes years and years and years for it to get spent, obviously that will be an issue. And then the third problem is a sort of productivity issue. So in some sectors, actually manufacturing has become more productive over time. You know, it produces a lot with fewer people, which is maybe a problem in its own right. But other industries are quite you know, slow to produce any gains. There's a very fascinating paper that I came across that found that the cost to build a mile of interstate highway has basically quadrupled from 1980 until now. The same patch of highway, The construction sector as a whole, productivity, there was a paper that just, an economics paper that just came out on this, arguing that productivity in the construction sector has actually declined over time. So, you know, if billions and billions are being spent, but they're being spent inefficiently, I mean, you're in New York, you know all about the efficiency of spending on infrastructure development, right?
Right.
You know, so they could get bogged down by reality, and we're going to be paying attention to that.
What's your take on what's making the construction industry inefficient nationwide?
That is something that I'm hoping to probe in a future article. Off the top of my head, I think that construction is quite ad hoc in terms of construction. So, you know, it's very hard for a certain kind of innovation to be transmitted to all the different projects because every project is sort of composed of its own team. And, you know, permitting is another issue. The pace of inspections that are required have made buildings safer, but maybe have also introduced more barriers in the sort of speedy production of buildings and all sorts of infrastructure. That would be my guess, but I haven't looked into it as closely as I'd like yet.
All right. We'll continue after a break with Idris Kaloun, Washington Bureau Chief for The Economist, as we talk about Biden's impact on the economy as a kind of preview of the State of the Union address tonight. Here's a program note. Our State of the Union coverage begins at 8 o'clock tonight when I will be back to host a pre-speech call-in. It'll be the State of Our Union is, and you fill in the blank, Kai Wright, host of Notes from America, and Lee Meringoff from the NPR Marist Poll will be along for the ride, too. Join me for that at 8 o'clock tonight and get ready to fill in the blank on the State of Our Union is. And then the speech itself begins at 9 here on WNYC. Jeff in Queens calling from the climate tech sector. We see you. You'll be the first call after the break. And Idris, get ready for me to ask you what you think January's eye-popping jobs number of 500,000 net new jobs created, even as the headlines were all about tens of thousands of layoffs in the tech sector. What does it all mean? So we'll continue in a minute. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Brian Lehrer on WNYC as we continue with Idris Kaloun, Washington Bureau Chief for The Economist, as we talk about Biden's impact on the economy, especially the manufacturing sector in the United States, as a one-issue preview of the State of the Union address tonight. And as promised, Jeff in Queens, you're on WNYC. Hi, Jeff.
Good morning, Brian. The thing point I wanted to make was I work in the climate tech sector. We're building technology to capture carbon and upgrade it to useful products. And my colleagues in Europe, in many cases, who are ahead on the core technology, are very interested in the United States. The changes Biden has put in place makes it very attractive to sell the technology in the United States rather than Europe with tax incentives and so on.
And we have a lot of noise on your line, but from what you know, are the European countries gearing up to compete against us in that respect? Or is what you're saying, oh, look what they're doing in the United States, we're going to buy their products?
Actually, the first. And I just read yesterday there were some kind of incentives being put in place, and people are saying it's too little, but they are panicked that their kind of core technology is being
competed with
in the States. Yes.
Jeff, I'm gonna leave it there because of all the noise in the background, but thank you for making an important point. We'll go next to Andres in Manhattan, calling about the CHIPS Act. Andres, you're on WNYC. Hi there.
Hi, Brian. Thanks so much. I'm working in the education sector, and I wanted to ask your guests about, I think the CHIPS Act is going to be impacting education enormously in that science, technology, engineering, and mathematics majors and both in high school and in community colleges and colleges, are going to be employable in these kinds of jobs, particularly in rural areas in upstate New York. It's going to have a huge impact. And I wonder if your guest has any insight into that.
Thank you. Idris?
Yeah, thank you for that point. You know, I think, yes, these will create jobs that rely on training in STEM, but we already have a pretty sizable gap in terms of the number of jobs that require training in STEM and our capacities to supply them. I'm worried about learning in general. You know, over the pandemic, we had a significant amount of learning loss that we're just getting a sense of the scale of. And a few months ago, we saw the release of NAEP scores, which are used to assess overall. That are used to assess overall performance, and we saw a pretty sizable decline in terms of performance. So I'm worried about those things in addition to what this might do for STEM. So that's the point I'd make there.
Which hopefully is short term after the remote learning era of the pandemic. But let me put this, or ask you to put this, into an maybe even larger context than we've been talking about, because one of the articles in The Economist that you sent us for this notes that the approach with these subsidies for manufacturing marks a major reversal from the U.S. government approach to economic success for the last 40 years. Free trade deals, low taxes, and relatively little regulation. And again, I'd say echoes of 1993, when Bill Clinton brought the Democrats on board with what had been more of a Republican approach described that way and made it bipartisan. So how much does Bidenomics actually represent a really epical end of an era in the Democratic Party?
I think it does. You're exactly right. I think it does encapsulate this turn away from the third way centrism of Bill Clinton that relied on liberalized trade agreements and low taxes and low regulations. And what's interesting is that what Bidenomics is, and I don't think people appreciate it quite as much, is that in some ways it's a continuation of Trumponomics. Biden has kept the same level of tariffs on China as Donald Trump did. He also thinks that the decline of manufacturing is a problem. He's skeptical of free trade agreements, all things that the two presidents, who have a lot of differences, share. So, this idea that buying America, buying American, is the way forward is actually one that's shared by people across the political spectrum. You know, people like Josh Hawley and Marco Rubio on the Republican side are increasingly interested in industrial policy. Donald Trump kept saying that he wanted to do, infrastructure investment along these lines. He was never able to. The only sort of significant piece of legislation he passed was the tax cuts in 2017. But, what Biden is doing is trying to put this vision into effect. And it is a stark departure from the bipartisan way in which economic policy was conducted years ago.
The January job numbers, to what extent is the eye-popping January jobs number of 500,000 plus net new jobs created in 1 month the fruits of these Biden bills and subsidies?
So it is the hangover of the COVID stimulus, right? So you had trillions of dollars being injected into the economy, which I think a lot of people would agree were necessary to stave off the consequences of the lockdown and its economic effects. But, what we've seen, the problem with, if you add that into the supply shocks, is that you've produced inflation, and the Federal Reserve has been trying to get that under control by raising interest rates. So the Federal Reserve actually probably looks at these numbers and thinks that, it hasn't tightened enough, and it might continue to increase rates as a result. Now, you mentioned the tech layoffs and how to think about those. And it's interesting, Facebook, sorry, it's called Meta now, but everyone forgets to say that. In November, they announced that they were cutting 13% of their workforce. which is 11,000 jobs. And, you know, in 2016, Facebook as a whole only had roughly that many employees. I mean, these companies went on a huge hiring spree over the course of the pandemic. And a lot of the time, and what we're seeing now is them moving back to levels of employment that they had in 2021 or 2020.
When we still considered them really big, right? I read the Google numbers. They went from like 90,000 employees to twice that, 180,000 employees, just in the last 5 years before this 12,000 layoff number that we heard the other week, which makes it sound like, oh my God, Google is drowning. But it's still like 70-something thousand more employees than they had 5 years ago.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. And I think that we've missed sometimes in the way that it's reported, right? The numbers sound very large, and you know, you wonder whether these companies are flailing, but they are just going back to hiring numbers that they had maybe even a year ago. You know, tech, unlike a lot of other industries, is very sensitive to the interest rates, right? Because a lot of their you know, future value relies on, you know, innovation and gains that are realized many years in the future. When money was free, things were, or nearly free, things were good. And now that money is tight, you know, there has to be a bit of belt tightening. But, you know, these companies ultimately, I think, are going to be fine.
Mike in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hi, Mike.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I am interested in learning if your guest believes that Biden's economic agenda, the successes that he's seen over the past year or two, if that has the ability to be counter-cyclical to any upcoming slowdown and what that would mean politically.
All right. As a Washington bureau chief, you are being asked for the first time in this segment to put your politics hat on as well as your economist hat.
Yeah, I think that, you know, counter-cyclical means that basically if there's a downturn in the economy, that that these policies will be able to kind of push the economy out of that rut. And I think that they will, right? You know, the traditional thing you do if you are in a depression, this is sort of Keynes's idea, is that you spend money and stimulate demand and get yourself out of it. That's what the idea was for Barack Obama's stimulus after the Great Recession. The problem is not so much whether or not it'll be countercyclical if we do have a recession, but whether or not it produces inflation in the near term, which is the issue that we're running into. It's not whether the economy is going too slow, it's whether it's going too fast and is too hot. So, you know, actually, and I think the pace of spending is meted out over the next 10 years such that the idea is that it won't exacerbate inflation. But definitely if things were to sour in the economy as a whole, you'd expect some of these subsidies to help provide some lift.
What's that 10-year economic subsidy number? You were getting at it before. Do you have it at the tip of your tip of your fingers?
I know it's something like 0.5% of GDP per year, you know, and if you multiply that by GDP, you'll get the number.
I think you had said something like $250 billion for subsidies for the semiconductor industry.
Yeah.
Am I remembering that right? And that's over how many years?
That's over the next 10 years.
Yeah. So I was thinking, if that's true, isn't that an incredible bargain for the taxpayers? For all those jobs, I mean, the government is spending $850 billion. You said $250 over 10 years. The government is spending $850 billion this year alone just for the Pentagon, and twice that much this year alone for Medicare and Social Security. So $25 billion this year for a generational reset of the whole economy and to revive manufacturing, if it works, that's an epical bargain.
Well, it depends on whether or not this money creates jobs only, or whether or not it incentivizes the private sector to do more. And you know, if it does do that, then obviously it is a big change. But you know, if you divide, for example, you know, the $98 billion that the IRA, the Inflation Reduction Act, is going to spend, if you divide that by the million jobs that it's expected to create, that's a governmental subsidy of $100,000 a worker, which is a lot. You know, hopefully it manifests itself in in innovations that produce a sort of more productive workforce. But on the whole, direct subsidy of governmental jobs can be quite expensive.
One more call. Billy in East Orange. You're on WNYC. Hi, Billy.
Hello.
Hello, Billy.
Can you hear me?
I can hear you. Can you hear me?
Oh, excellent. I'm sorry. Okay. Let me say one thing. One irony about talking about River Rouge as this massive place in the 30s, 50,000 people employed. Of course, we know who owns that joint. That's Mr. Henry Ford, who was nice enough to accept an award from Adolf Hitler in 1938, since Mr. Hitler thought Henry Screed's about Jews was so good that he actually...
That's the 1930s. Talk about today.
I know. Okay, today. So we have approximately 52 million workers in the United States making $15 an hour or less, about 20 million making $10 an hour or less. We have 20 million children going to bed hungry every night. We have a Department of War with 1,000 bases approximately in 80 different countries spending over $1 trillion a year. I think we have some really big messes because decision-making is kind of like for profit.
So, right. Well, that's a good... You point out important things, and it's kind of a theory of everything. Billy, thank you very much. And, you know, we had some callers yesterday, too, when we were talking about the economy, Idris, saying that January, despite all those new jobs, was an example of the ravages of modern capitalism. Good-paying jobs were disappearing, like those tech jobs. Low-wage jobs, like in healthcare and retail and hospitality, plus gig economy jobs that don't have the benefits, like Billy was just saying, were being created, more redistribution of wealth away from the workers and toward the owners. How much do the stats that you're seeing bear that out?
I think they're not going to be captured in a single month of jobs figures. I think that the right stats to look at are the decade-long trends in inequality, the decade-long trends in poverty, and wages. And, you know, that requires probably another hour or two of dissection to really get at the roots of those trends. But I will say that, the legislation that we're talking about now is geared towards jobs, and it is geared towards, climate change mitigation. And there are other things, that other pieces of legislation that would aim to address those problems. One thing that I've written about extensively is the child tax credit, and actually which was implemented over the course of COVID and had the effect of reducing child poverty by 40%, which I think was a sort of heroic coup, which didn't get enough notice. But, you know, there are different legislations that deal with different problems, and the Biden administration does have an issue sometimes in describing its economic agenda and sort of theory of everything terms, which sometimes hinders comprehensibility among the general public. But I do think that there are different solutions for all these problems.
And that is one of the things that I'll be curious to hear tonight. Will he propose reviving the child tax credit, which we certainly have talked about on this show as having reduced child poverty by about half, according to the stats that were available, and it got killed by the Republicans in the Senate. We'll see if he tries to bring that back as a standalone, as one of the things that he proposes tonight. And there's a lot more that we will see tonight at 9 o'clock when the president gives his State of the Union address. For now, we thank Idris Kalun, Bureau Chief in D.C. for The Economist, for talking through some of the economic backdrop for Bidenomics and the speech that he might give tonight. It was a great conversation. Thank you very, very much.
Great. Thank you so much for inviting me.